the rattle of the chain shortly. The sun rays began opening the bridge hatches. I saw Weddle and Mixon start toward the hold and called, "Sun rays? Not yet. The police aren't used to the fog and crap, and we'd none of us be here if it wasn't for them helping." I sneezed violently. I'd slitted my eyes, but they were watering anyway. Frankly, I'd have been just as happy if my crew hadn't been so quick to prove how tough they were by letting in the steam and ions that would hang over the Alfraz for another 10 minutes. The sparkling fog thinned as it cooled, so I switched my display to real-time visuals. I could see people waiting on the seawall, which ran for a half mile along the river frontage. But I wondered why they'd brought us down here instead of closer to the grain docks. Then a barge and a second barge following pulled slowly between us and the seawall. Even before they dropped anchor, I saw teams on their decks readying walkways to link all of us in a chain to the shore. "Ship," I called. "I'm opening the main hatch. Everybody remain aboard until I get direction from harbor control." The hatch began to grind down, filling the ship with fog rather than steam, with just a tang of ozone. Because our anchorage wasn't enclosed, landing didn't involve the usual stink of burned garbage. "Alfraz," the console said, "you are free to disembark. Control out." I decided not to bother with an anchor watch. I keyed the PA system and said, "All personnel, Saguntum is proud of you, and by heaven, so am I. You are all free to disembark. Captain out." The sun rays on the bridge with me paused for the police contingent, some pairs using couches as stretchers, to clear the boarding ramp. Then they followed. I started after them, holding Monica closely. Maeve Grimaud, standing beside the hatch, said, "Mistress Folliot, you probably want to greet your father. Roy will be along in just a moment." Monica looked at her, then smiled with her lips and said, "Yes, Dad's probably been worried. Roy, I'll see you soon." She turned to me and lifted to give me a quick peck. "Don't forget me, please," she said as she slipped out the hatch. "Ah, Maeve," I said, liking the situation only slightly more than I had finding her and Monica both waiting when I entered the Alfraz. "I plan to tell anybody who'll listen that you're the reason Saguntum owns its orbital space, and that you saved my life besides." "I guessed you'd think that," Maeve said, "and I'm sure nobody else will tell you different, so I will. The only reason those three sloops lifted to join you is that Monica Folliot gave a speech to the crews that made them ashamed to do anything else. Believe me, they'd plan to stay in barracks, whether or not there were Alliance guards. Many of them aren't even from Saguntum, remember?" She grinned in a fashion that I remembered. "They're men, though," she said. "And she made them believe they wouldn't be if they didn't go up to help you. And this ship," she rapped her knuckles on the bulkhead, "wouldn't have been much use if there was still a Kars destroyer in orbit." Her face settled slightly. "Though we'd have tried. Your sun rays were clear on that, and Monica and I were going to tag along." I swallowed. "Thank you, Maeve," I said. She was probably right that nobody else would have told me. "That's all I had to say," she said. She turned toward the hatch. "Maeve," I said. "If I can ask, how did you get the roadblock to withdraw for the commando to enter?" "An order from the Alliance Communication Center directed the troops at Holywell Street to reinforce the roadblock on the next street to the east," she said. "A signals lieutenant thought he was allowing my fiancé to escape. And if you wonder how he was bribed to do that," Maeve's smile was as hard and cold as a scimitar blade. "Let's just say that not every young officer is as iron-willed as you are, Lieutenant Olfetri." I bowed to her. Maeve left the bridge, and a moment later, I followed.
"Your alert saved us," Colonel Folliot said as he grasped my hand on the pier. "I knew we couldn't hold them in Jacquerie, and I didn't want the kind of bloodbath that'd mean anyway. But I was able to get most of my people and even some of the Jacquerie regiment out of the city." Borodin had looked like a tent camp as Alfraz thundered down for a landing. At sea level, it wasn't much different. The original buildings, mostly stabilized earth and structural plastic, were surrounded by and interspersed with structures whose walls were flattened cans and packing crates with tarpaulin roofs. Folliot followed my eyes. "Sanitation's a problem," he said, "and we're bloody lucky they didn't invade and fall when the rains start. We're trucking in water from upstream, but there's no way to purify it besides boiling." I could see that many of the barges drawn up along both banks were being converted into accommodations also. They couldn't all have come from Jacquerie. I asked, "Do you have a government?" "I'm ruling in the name of President Perez," Folliot said. I tried to warn him, but I couldn't get through his bloody staff. General Meyerberg, he's the Alliance CO. He's tried to get Perez to welcome Alliance help, but Israel's got balls enough for two, so that isn't going anywhere. What we've got for now is a stalemate. He made a sweep of his arm. "Folks are coming in from all the farms," he said. "There's 3,000 militia here on the way, and I've got about 1,000 with training, my commando and army. What we don't have is guns, but even if Meyerberg could get his people over the mountains, there's no way they can take Borodin. He's got about 1,200 troops, but there's 50 armored personnel carriers with automatic impellers. I can't push that out of Jacquerie with what I've got."
Sir, I said, "how are we going to proceed?"
"We're going to sit on our hands," the colonel said. "The future of Saguntum is going to be decided by whoever gets reinforced. If an Alliance squadron shows up, I'll capitulate. It's that simple. If it's Cinnabar, then Meyerberg will, if he's got any sense." Folliot gave me the sort of smile you might expect from a man on the gallows. "I've killed plenty of people in my time," he said. "I don't need to kill more for no bloody reason. So we'll hold what we've got and wait for the odds to change, one way or the other." I took a deep breath. "And with your approval, sir," I said, "I'll set up a training and patrol schedule for the sloops. After they come in, of course. There's obviously nothing wrong with the courage of the crews, but we can work on more effective tactics. And I'll integrate the sun rays into the local personnel, just to have the experience available if needed." Folliot smiled sadly. "I used to have energy," he said. "The man who just created a functioning state a matter of days after the old one was destroyed. But given that the sloops are still in orbit, I suggest you take the rest of the day off." He looked away, cleared his throat, and added, "And Olfetri, thank you for bringing my daughter back from Ben Yusuf. And, well, thank you." "Yes, sir," I said. Monica was waiting 10 feet down the pier, seeming to view the landscape of transformed Borodin. It was good to have her in my life. I expected arguments from my new command, at least from some of the Saguntine spacers. Instead, they acted like I'd been sent from the heavens to guide them. Part of it may have been Red, who made it sound like I'd put Elcano close enough to our target to reach out and touch it. We'd been close enough in all truth, but some of that was luck. And nobody seemed put off by the hammering Elcano had gotten. The wreckage was still drifting away from Saguntum, maybe out of sight, really was out of mind. A portion of the Culner near the stern continued to orbit, the battle direction center and compartments immediately forward and below. Using that as a target, I demonstrated to each crew how to slip into the matrix, then extract to launch attacks. Only Esterhazy of the Saguntine captains could really astrogate so cleanly, but it was good exercise for the others, and they might get lucky. At worst, it was better than lining up in normal space the way they'd done with the Medusa. If they'd been facing the Culner instead, she'd have knocked all three of them down before they got into dart range. I kept one sloop in space at all times, trading off every 4 hours. I took a tour daily, moving from one sloop to the next. I got to know the crews better that way and showed myself to them besides. They were a good bunch, a lot better than I'd given them credit for being when I first met them. I'd gone up in Magellanes with Gadiant added to the Saguntine crew and Smith as captain. Smith had made the insertion on the command screen while I was shadowing him from the striker seat. My calculation showed that Smith's course would put us about 100,000 miles out from the drifting target, too far for effective use of a dart, but I'd go over it with him in private after we landed. In fact, we were within 50,000 miles, still too far, but 10 times better than Smith could have managed at the start. But I wasn't paying attention to the exercise. We'd extracted to find a fleet orbiting Saguntum. "Saguntine ship Magellanes," announced my consul. "Lay to and prepare to be boarded. Do not make any hostile move by orders of Commodore Leary, commanding Combined Force Harbinger, over." I'm good on voices. Despite being distorted by transmission, I recognized Lady Mundy speaking. "Sir," Captain Smith said through the link, "has Cinnabar rescued us then?" "A lot of the ships are from the 7th Destroyer Flotilla," I said. "The Ariadne's an Alliance cruiser, though, and there's at least 2 fleet destroyers besides." But we had more important business than figuring out what was going on. "Magellanes to Rotterdam," I said. "We understand your instructions and are obeying. Our dart firing circuits are locked at the console." Sir, what's happening? Gadiant asked, leaning toward me. He didn't sound worried exactly, but spacers don't like surprises.
Ship, we're waiting for Captain Leary to send somebody to board us, I said.
That's all I know, but I smiled around the cabin. I'm happier now than I was a little bit ago.
A pinnace pulled away from the Rotherham. That was a bit of a surprise because it was larger than I'd thought any RCN destroyer carried. Even destroyer leaders like the Rotherham and Quilliam in the 7th Flotilla. Because we had time, I queried the pinnace's embedded data and learned it was assigned to the light cruiser Ariadne. Ship, I said, because I thought it was a good idea that everybody on Elcano was aware of the situation before people came aboard. The boat arriving to search us is from the Alliance. This isn't a problem. Captain Leary sent it to us. Captain out.
I certainly hoped it wasn't a problem.
Smith, I said, linking with the Saguntine captain. I'll take over now, if I may.
Smith didn't just agree, he thanked me.
Ship cutting power, I said.
Then I set the sails to furl.
Gadiant took the riggers out to guide the process. When the sticks were bare, I retracted and clamped the rig. I didn't know what Captain Leary had in mind for us, but I didn't think it would involve maneuvering through the matrix. Lowering the rig would make it easier to come aboard.
The pinnace came alongside expertly. The boat had steam jets for extremely low impulse movements, but this coxswain didn't need them. They joined faster than I thought was safe, but it braked alongside with precise enthusiasm. The airlock rotated open and two spacers in rigging suits came out on the hull. One cast a magnetic grapple toward our hull. Gadiant caught it and manually slapped it down. The next surprise was that three more figures got out wearing air suits. The riggers actually walked them to the line and crossed before and behind what must be a group of laymen. I'd hoped, didn't make any sense, but I had, that Six himself would be boarding us. I wanted somebody to take over so that I could stop thinking. Our airlock opened. The man who entered first with his helmet off was unfamiliar to me. He said, "I'm Colonel Grzynski of the Forces, the Alliance military. Captain Leary suggested that the safest way to get me down to Borodin would be for you to take me, Captain Olfetri. We realize that you might have doubts." That was putting it mildly. "But Lady Mundy is here to vouch for what I've told you." And there she was when he stepped aside, and Tovera smirking beside her. "Yes," Mundy said. "We will announce ourselves after we land, but it appeared to all parties." She paused, and I could almost see her mind revisiting to what she had just said. "All the principles to the decision, that is, that it will be safest if we land as part of the existing order of business, rather than arousing particular attention. Do you see any problem with that?"
"No, ma'am," I said. "As soon as the rest of the crew is aboard, we'll do just that."
The airlock was cycling behind our passengers, bringing in Gadiant and the remaining Saguntines. I manually keyed Kamo and said, "Borodin Control, this is Sloop Magellanes. We're coming in as scheduled." I tweaked the automatic landing system of the Lezo, much the way I'd done with the Alfraz, but I hadn't gotten around to Magellanes or Concha yet. Regardless, I'd let the console land us. The thrusters had a nasty lateral wobble in final approach, but it never became dangerous. Watching the pinnace match velocity with us had made me very well aware of how much I had to learn about ship handling. I'd keep on training, but not while carrying Lady Mundy and an Alliance envoy, who didn't want to be put down an Alliance-held jacquerie. Though I'd said that we were making a scheduled landing, Control knew better, and so did Colonel Folliot. Judging from the fact that he and half a dozen aides were waiting on the pier for me to open up the Magellanes, I didn't let the situation rush me. Well, rush me very much. Magellanes had only four thrusters, and we were anchored on an estuary flush by the river and by the regular winds up and down the channel. I shaved 2 minutes off our cooling time. "Ship opening up," I said, and pressed execute. "Crew, stay on board until our passengers have gotten off." Mundy turned to me. "Officer Olfetri," she said, "I suggest you join us when we meet Director Folliot."
"Yes, ma'am," I said, same as I'd have done if she told me to jump into the harbor.
I followed Tovera, who in turn followed her mistress and the envoy across the walkway. When they'd all reached the 6 steps to the pier, I turned and waved back to the Magellanes. My crew, waiting for release in the boarding hold, poured out.
"Director Folliot," Lady Mundy said as he joined her, "this is Colonel Grzynski. He's here to end the fighting."
Folliot was in battle dress and carried a pistol in a shoulder holster. Grzynski had been wearing a dress uniform under his air suit, and he'd brought a saucer hat as well. It must have been designed to compress, because he'd been holding nothing when he crossed from the pinnace. The two colonels shook hands. Folliot straightened and said, "I don't recognize your branch of service, Colonel."
"We wear the same ranks and uniforms as the army," Grzynski said, tapping his lapel insignia. "But our chain of command in the 5th Bureau is separate."
"Ah," said Folliot. "Shall we go into my office where we can discuss your terms in private?"
"There are no terms, Director," Grzynski said. "A colleague, in a different diocese, exceeded his authority by committing the alliance to warlike actions without clearing them with the guarantor. I'm here to correct his mistake as quickly and completely as possible."
"Bloody hell," Folliot said in a quiet voice. I hadn't realized how tense he'd been until that moment. His flesh suddenly hung on the bones like a snapped elastic.
"Lady Mundy said that you might have an air car," Grzynski said. "If that's true and you're willing to lend it for this purpose, I believe we can take care of the business very quickly."
He smiled.
"I thought we could inform General Meyerberg that you're sending peace envoys," he added. "Our first concern was that your forces not shoot us down when we landed, which is why we used one of your own ships. The second concern is the reverse of that, but we believe Meyerberg will take good care of anyone whom he believes can get him out of the hole into which he's dug himself."
"The car and a driver are at your disposal," Folliot said. Then he repeated, "Bloody hell." Epilogue. I'd planned that the naval strike force would end the march with a jog for the last half mile back to barracks. But after the 9th mile, I radioed Mixon, who was in the lead, and told him to bag the notion. As it was, two of the Saguntines were clinging to me as we staggered the last 100 yards, and each of my sun rays helped support another. Besides, Weddle had three who'd collapsed in the cart she was hauling behind a farm tractor. I think the only reason the sun rays and I were doing so well was that we were embarrassed at the thought of giving up in front of the Saguntines. "Catch you in the showers," I wheezed to the spacers I'd been helping. I moved over to where Weddle had pulled up to help her with the people who'd gotten a lift in the cart. They were actually in better shape than I was after having a few miles rest. Lieutenant Smith was among them. "Sir," he said, "my right calf cramped. I'll do better next time, I swear I will." "We all will," I said, "and I'll know better the next time than to start the program with a 10-mile hike." "Need a hand, sir?" Weddle said. From the worry on her face, I wonder what I looked like. "No, just park the tractor and show up at 0800, I said. Before we started off, I told my people they were automatically dismissed for the day when we got back. A shower would feel good, especially if there was still something left of the water that the sun had been warming in the rack of drums while we were gone. I was so tired that I only noticed the men who'd been waiting on the bench in front of the barracks when they got to their feet. The figures could have been bushes for all the impression they'd made on me, but my eyes registered the motion. "Good afternoon, Olfetri," Captain Leary said. The man beside him was Hogg. "Sir," I said, and tried to straighten to attention. I started to topple. Hogg's left hand steadied me. He didn't say anything, but he smiled. "Let's sit down on this very comfortable bench for a moment," the captain said. He was smiling, too. "I'm sorry, sir," I said as I thumped down. "I'm trying to get the strike force into shape, but I started out with too ambitious a program. Bloody near too ambitious for me, obviously." The Army Engineer Company had put in the bench in front when they built us the barracks. Most troops and all the militia were in tents or shelters they built themselves, but I'd asked Director Folliot to jump the strike force to the head of the line. Somebody had to be first after all, and my boys had seen real action. "I watched you coming in," Captain Leary said. "I'd say you were doing pretty well." "But you said strike force?" "Well, I changed the name for, well," I said. "Anyway, I changed the name to reflect what we really do. That attack on Karst wasn't defense, after all, and we cleared hostile vessels out of the system pretty actively."
"Indeed," Leary said. "Exercising together should help build team spirit, too."
Without changing his mildly positive tone, he went on, "Are you planning to build a career here?"
"Sir," I said.
I'd have jumped to my feet, except I was pretty sure my legs would dump me back on my arse, looking like a fool. "Sir, I've just been doing this until you gave me orders to do something else."
"You've clearly done very well," Leary said, "but you're technically a civilian and wouldn't have to answer to anybody if you wanted to take a position on Saguntum. And before you answer, you should know that Resident Jimenez had made a strong request that I transfer you to the diplomatic service at the rank of Counselor of Mission."
"What?" I said.
"Indeed," Leary said, bobbing his head. I gather the status of the position varies depending on the importance of the world involved. But even on Saguntum, you'd be the equivalent of a lieutenant commander in the RCN. Why in heaven's name would Jimenez recommend that, I said. I hadn't seen the foreign ministry delegation since before the invasion. They'd been captured along with Perez and the civilian government when the Kafirstan Dom landed. I gather he's convinced that you held Saguntum to its friendship with the Republic while he and his staff were incarcerated, Leary said. And from what I've seen, he may have been right. No, sir, I said. Colonel Folliot was Saguntum until you came back and freed the civil government. He could be that now if he wanted to be, and he wasn't going to cut a deal with the Alliance. I wondered how much Maeve had to do with the Foreign Ministry offer. I wondered a lot of things about Maeve. Taking a deep breath, I got carefully to my feet. Leary and Hogg stood also. I said, Sir, what I want to be is an officer of the RCN. If you can arrange it for me to re-enter the Academy, I'll be eternally grateful. I think this... I waved sort of generally, indicating the harbor and the Rotterdam now floating there. We'd heard the destroyer descending halfway through the hike, but it hadn't occurred to me that it meant anything in particular for me. It's been enough to make people forget my dad. I hope so, anyway. Captain Leary pursed his lips over a thought. Sir, I said, you don't have to do that. Do anything more for me to be eternally thankful. I'll enlist as a common spacer if I have to and work my way into a commission that way. That's not easy, Leary said, but you know, I think you might be able to pull it off. Still, I don't think third-year cadet is really the best use of you. You're aware that my current post makes me a commodore. Yes, sir, I said. He was the captain in charge of a squadron, or in this case, flotilla, because they were destroyers. The rank permits me to appoint a flag lieutenant, Captain Leary said. That's a dog's body, really, an aide who might have to do any bloody thing that might come up. Hogg snorted. And he means any bloody thing, he said, except for women. Them he can take care of himself. Leary's smile wasn't directed at me. I'm not sure it was directed at anybody. A range of duties, at any rate, he said. The choice out here is slimmer than it would be on Cinnabar. But even on Cinnabar, I don't think I could find a better man for the position than you've proven to be in the time I've known you. Do you want the job, Ofetri? Sir, I said. I was afraid I was going to cry, but that wouldn't be the first time I'd embarrassed myself. Sir, there's some things I need to take care of here. I wanted Monica in my life, forever, if that was possible. But if she wanted me as I hoped she did, she was getting an RCN officer. But sir, yes, if you'll have me. I did start crying. I tried to salute when I remembered to, but as my hand rose, Captain Leary gripped and shook it.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Though Hell Should Bar the Way, RCN Series, Book 12. Written by David Drake. Performed by Victor Bavine. Executive producers Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer Neil Basic. Copyright 2018 by David Drake. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.